Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Thank you, Peter. Tonight, instead of a Dharma talk, we're going to have a question and answer session with our teacher, Les Kay. So you'll have an opportunity to ask questions about your practice or any other related things. So welcome, Les.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Oh, I'm really happy to be here with all of you tonight. We haven't been together very much in the last several months or years, and we've missed. I think we've all missed the closeness that we have when we are together in person. And we've had to adjust and learn to be with each other as best we can in this, what we call a virtual way. But if we pay attention and we give our awareness to each other, we can have a warm feeling and continue our sense of community. And I'm hoping that in the near future, we can come back together again in person. So as Diane said, tonight, instead of a Dharma talk, let's open up this discussion to any questions you might have about practice or about how we're doing, about how you're doing, and just about anything that's relevant to Canando's activity and our own spirituality. So would anybody like to, does anybody have a question they'd like to ask?
Excuse me, Les, I have you spotlighted, so if you want to look at gallery view instead
okay.
of yourself, and do that.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Then you can see everyone.
I can see everyone. That's nice.
I reviewed the lecture on negotiating your own terrain. I forget the exact title. This first isn't a question so much as I was really struck how much the approach that you outlined and detailed in that lecture, Les, was similar to the only original philosophy that has arisen in America, pragmatism, what William James called radical empiricism, where you don't proceed on the basis of a theory or a deduction, but you pay attention to your experience and experiments. And I just wanted to somehow, looking at the lecture again, I could see that in a way, clearly in a way that I hadn't before, and admire it. One thing that came up, it's kind of a trivial question, but because one thing that came up about Canando, as you mentioned, that the emphasis in Canando is not on verbal It's more on learning yourself rather than verbal teaching, which is consistent with this notion that one of the participants in the lecture mentioned that he found it impossible to really receive things from his parents, for instance, that were like already preserved and presented, but it was necessary for him to find out for himself. There are other ways, maybe, other than looking for the answers in verbal communication that I know you value, because you mentioned it in your lectures. When you talk about books or movies, sometimes even, and I just wanted, if you could comment a little more on maybe there are different kinds of verbal communications, you know, one that provides the answers and the other that inspire us or challenge us to find our own way. Thank you.
Our practice does not emphasize verbal communication. It's a starting point. We have to communicate with each other because we share our lives and we share this space called Earth. And in order to live harmoniously, we have to communicate. But when it comes to understanding our true self, who we are, before there is verbal communication, we have to put it aside for a time and just pay attention to who we are nonverbally. And there's no describing it and no defining it, and there's no measuring it. We each make that effort to discover who we are before the words arise, before the feelings arise, before the mind engages in solving the problems of the everyday world. In a way, you know, all nature communicates. All beings and all sentient beings communicate in ways that we don't understand. And it's not with words or sounds. There's an intrinsic way that we know each other. And how we come to that knowing is the foundation of our practice. How do we know who we are fundamentally before we have a personality? How do we know who we are collectively before we define ourselves individually? And that's what our practice is about, being very, very quiet in our words and our thoughts and our feelings, so that our natural, or inherent, intrinsic, natural quality can appear. So I can't comment very much about the different ways that we might communicate verbally. I'll leave that up to the, I have to leave that up to the philosophers. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
Phil, thank you for your years of continued practice and of your dedication and of the seriousness of your practice. You've been away from us physically, geographically for a long time, but it's really good to have you back.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so grateful to be here.
Hi, Les. Can you hear me?
Yes, Anna.
Hi.
I can hear you.
I had a question about the new year.
The new year.
a lot of people are, you know, making plans and thinking back and looking ahead. And I think it can be skillful sometimes to spend a little time planning or even dreaming up what your future could look like. How do you balance that in our everyday world, that wisdom of sometimes doing that with our practice of not getting too attached to those plans or those dreams? And taking care of our life now.
Well, I think it is important, even vital, to from time to time assess the world we're in, the world that we've inherited and that we've given ourselves, and what we need to do, what our responsibilities are. You know, our practice is not just about spending all of our time doing nothing or thinking nothing. We have a life, and we have a mind, we have a body, we have this form given to us in some way we maybe not fully understand, but we have a responsibility to take care of it. That's part of our practice. It's a very practical, it's the very practical expression of our practice. So it is important from time to time to stop and look at our world and look at what it is we have to take care of and what we should be taking care of. And New Year's, of course, is you know, the most famous way of doing that, looking ahead and making resolutions for a new year. But it's the sort of thing we should do from time to time, maybe even every day. You start your day and you have to set off and do practical things. And you say, what are those things? How do I make sure I do them well? Is there anything that's going to interfere with the quality of what I'm doing? So that's part of our practice too. Looking ahead, establishing our vision for how we want to live this life with quality, and setting our mind to it. So I think some people take New Year's resolutions a little bit in fun, maybe a little bit carelessly, a little bit trivially, but it has a deep meaning. It has a deep meaning. What should I be doing? How should I do it? What vows do I have to make? What vows do I have to remember so that I can continue this practice and share it with everyone? So I think, I don't know where the New Year's resolution idea came from, but it's a practice that most people do, and I think it's important. And I think we should consider it with some seriousness and not just in some party way. So I think the New Year's celebration can be, if we look at it seriously, can be included in our practice if we go beyond the, you know, the fun part and just be quietly serious about what we're going to do tomorrow and in the weeks ahead.
Thank
it's
you,
our
Les.
Practice. Thank you. Hello, May.
Hello, Les.
Hi, May.
Nice to see you.
See you.
Well, thank you for Philip, your question, and then thank you for your answer. Honestly, I don't believe I am able to hear you for a long, long time, Les. Even I have ears, I am not able to listen for a long, long time. But even I say today I understand you, maybe I'm still wrong. but that's okay, you know, I figure, but I believe you contribute to my faith. So doesn't matter, you know, you contribute to this balance and then stability to stick to it. I do have a question. This is just come because for a long time I don't know what is compassion is. You know, I questioned and then I am not able to listen. Even I hear something, I'm not sure, you know. So I started to look at precepts. So of course there are many books about precepts. They said the precept is the blood vein. Sorry, I still have to be very compassionate to my small mind because my small mind has a question. So the question is, if precept is blood vein, so what is bone marrow? You know, I don't know. what is bone marrow of our practice?
What? Could you say it again? What is
bone? Bone, marrow.
Bone
marrow.
Oh, bone marrow.
Bone marrow. Sorry.
Bone yes. marrow.
Yes, I
understand.
Yeah. So this is my small mind question. I still have to take care of it. Thank you.
May.
Yes.
That's not your small mind question. That's your big mind question.
Oh.
That's the most important question anybody could ask. What is my marrow? And there's a story about that. Bodhidharma, when he was getting old and he wanted to pass on his teaching to his students. He had spoke to his four students. And I don't remember exactly, but he told one student, you are my skin. He told the other student, you are my flesh. And he told one, you're my bone. And to the final student who became a successor, he said, you have my marrow. So the idea, the concept of marrow goes very deep, a significant part of our practice. And, you know, when you read that story, there is no explanation about what he meant. So we have to contemplate that and live with that. What is the marrow of our practice? And Bodhidharma attributed that quality to just one of his students. So the question, your question about what is the bone marrow? That's the very question that each one of us is understanding for ourselves. That's what we're working on. What is it that's so fundamental that provides the essence of our being, the marrow of our being? What is that? Can you say anything about it? Can you describe it? What is that? That's what our Zazen practice is about, returning to our marrow, being our marrow. Where the life-giving substance is born, where our spiritual being resides. So your question is exceptionally deep, and you've joined with Bodhidharma through your question. Well, I think Umar.
Hi, Les.
Hey, Umar.
How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm okay tonight.
Okay, good. So I had some feelings to share. I feel recently I've been feeling very angry, frustrated, and very confused. And sometimes I feel like people don't take ownership for where they are, where they go, how they treat places or people. And there's a lack of relationship with things and with other people. And seems to me more and more people read books and take courses and apply those principles. And so I just feel very confused sometimes because I feel that people are not being themselves or being sincere. It's just a disguise that they're putting on. And I'm not saying this as a complaint, but this is sometimes it just makes me very frustrated because I see sometimes that I see them for who they are, that yet they're trying to hide who they are. And so I just get frustrated. And, Canandaigua is a great place. And, you know, I feel sometimes that more and more people need to feel, and this is only my feeling, that they have an ownership towards it and a relationship towards it. And I don't see that sometimes. It really frustrates me. And I don't know what else to say sometimes. So I just keep my mouth shut. And sometimes I feel like I'm the only one who's doing everything. It just, it becomes a little too much. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing with us how you feel, Umar. That's very honest. And it's very rare. Everybody and anybody who comes to this practice, searching or seeking, with a strong desire to express themselves fully and truly, everybody is making their best effort. Everybody. And, it really doesn't help us if we look at people and rate them on a scale of, how well they're doing or judge them. Do we give them a grade of 25% or 90%? It doesn't make any difference. That doesn't help. We just simply have to trust everybody is making their best effort and everybody is learning. We are all learning how to make that effort because for many of us, it doesn't come naturally. So in order to learn more about how to make our best effort, we have to unlearn some things that are in our past. And I think what you're feeling, what you're seeing and experiencing is the difficulty that people have in unlearning what they sense is getting in the way. It's hard to unlearn those things that we've been carrying around for so many years. I think My suggestion is to just simply trust that people are making their best effort to learn what it is they need to learn, and to unlearn what it is that's holding them back, or that's providing, or that is the source of delusion. One of the things that everybody wants, not just Zen students, but everybody, is to be free of confusion and free of delusion, free of false notions of what reality is. Even people who say, you know, I'm not interested in Buddhism, I'm not interested in Zen, the everyday world is all there is. Those people too are, they desperately want to be free of delusion. They may not be practicing it, but the people who come to the practice are doing just that. They're practicing freeing themselves from delusion. And sometimes that the path is a little bit rocky and people stumble. We stumble as we try to let go. So just trust. Don't take it too seriously. Let's support each other and let's help each other find our own way in our journey of discovery. Thank you. Oh, Paul. Yes. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Les. Thank you. So my question is, so I think I understand that the main thing is to sit and just sit without trying to achieve anything in particular and try and do clear the mind and breathing and posture and those things. And I'm trying to make that a habit and just do it without thinking about it. But my question is, well, question A is that correct? And then question B is it, given that it's, you're not trying to achieve something in particular, is it okay or bad to sit when one is agitated or troubled for the purpose of clearing the mind?
Oh, it's more than okay, you know. It's easy to sit when our mind is not disturbed. But that's not the only time we should engage in our practice. So even when things aren't going well, when there are some difficulties we're dealing with, when we're troubled by something, that's the best time to sit. Sit right in the midst of our difficulties. Because actually what we're doing, like Suzuki Roshi tells us, Dogen tells us, we sit in the midst of our delusions. And that takes a bit of an effort, but that's the only way to find clarity. So to sit only when we feel comfortable is, it's just, that's just a pastime. We come to our cushion at the designated time, independent of how we may be feeling at that moment. So if we're troubled, we just sit anyhow. If there are things that are difficult for us, we just sit. And just give our attention to our whole being. Yeah, it's more than okay. It's more than okay. It's a fundamental attitude that we bring to practice. And actually, when you think about it, all of us who come to practice, we come because we have, you know, something on our mind, some confusion or some difficulty or something we need to resolve. So we come to practice in the midst of some difficulty, and that's the way we start. And that's the spirit of our practice. Just keep coming to our cushion and allow ourselves to be selfless. Allow our being to be selfless, to return to selflessness. So I encourage myself, and I encourage all of you, come to Zazen with whatever is going on in your life, whether it's pleasant or something that needs to take care of. We drop off those considerations and just come to selfless Zazen. Thank you.
Chris has his hand up.
Oh, Chris.
Thank you, Diane. Just to piggyback on Paul's question a little bit, wondering if you could add color or maybe some wisdom for somebody who's just starting their Zazen practice, and where maybe it started off well, full attentiveness to the moment, but has more, myself, I'm more recently having difficulty just to quiet the mind and to be in the moment, just. And it's actually been quite scary to not be able to block out the mind and to keep it from wandering in directions that and I guess the question I really have is this something that is normal for people who practice, that they go through this kind of periods of time where it becomes difficult, or is it unique, or is it? I imagine it's probably not unique, but if you could just add some color to that, that'd be
okay.
Helpful.
Does anybody here tonight not have the experience that Chris is describing? Chris, it's normal. It's the universal experience when we first start to practice. When we do experience that, the important point is to not give up too quickly and say, I can't do this. I can't quiet my mind. Everybody here tonight, nobody here tonight did that. They just continued. They recognized that the mind is just going on, and there's an expression, a Zen expression, it's called monkey mind. The monkey that jumps from tree to tree and doesn't stop. And we all, with some humor, acknowledge to each other our monkey mind, but we come back to our cushion anyhow, and we say to ourselves, I'm not going to let that discourage me. I'm not going to quit. Something will be revealed as I do this practice, despite the monkey mind that seems so present, so ever present right now. So it's normal. It's not unique. It's universal. But with patience, you'll find that the monkeys start to settle down. They become a little bit more content with themselves. They stop chasing around after things they don't need. And from that experience, we develop confidence. So you live with your monkey mind for now. Just go ahead.
Very comforting. Thank you.
Les, in the chapter called Zen and Character in your book, in your and Teresa's book, A Search for Something Greater, you begin by relating a story of a student asking you why you came to Zen practice. And your answer is that you didn't want to be a jerk anymore. And I know that when I'm a jerk, not infrequently, it seems like an ego explosion. And at the very beginning, whatever it is that's causing me to feel that way, there's just a moment where I hear a voice saying, don't do it, bad idea. And then another voice saying, go ahead, you were wrong, you were completely in the right, they wronged you. And there's a jerk explosion, which I feel very regretful for and remorse. And my question is, it seems like if that first moment, that this little gap moment where I did think, oh, this is a bad idea, if I just had a little bit longer in it to think a little bit longer, the explosion wouldn't happen. My first question is, how do I expand that moment? How do I lengthen that moment? And secondly, is that the right question to be asking?
The way to expand it is simply to continue to acknowledge to yourself that this sort of thing happens, to recognize that it's not what you want, that you want just the opposite, and to just keep going. And that will expand it. And yes, it's perfectly fine question to ask of ourselves and of each other. Just continue. Hernan, how are you?
Hi, Les. How are you? It's good to see you.
Okay.
Les, I wanted to ask you something. Buddhism starts with the recognition of suffering, and that there are causes for suffering. Our practice is about reducing those causes so we suffer less. Some days ago, I saw someone suffer deeply, and I suffered deeply, and then the situation changed, and I was overcome by gratitude. And it caught my attention that I had the perception that gratitude is a word that we don't use much in teachings. It doesn't appear explicitly much in teachings, although I can see it in the teachings. It's subtly there. And every bowing is an act of gratitude. Today, Philip Olson mentioned that he was grateful. And I had the feeling that our practice a lot about gratitude. And I wanted to ask you if there are teachings that explicitly address gratitude, or I may be wrong, but if it's true that gratitude is not a word much used in teachings, why do you think it is so? And what is the relation that you see between gratitude and our practice?
That's a good question. The practice that we have today, we have inherited it from a totally different culture. Our practice comes from has evolved through Asian cultures. And it's possible, it's likely that they felt that expressing personal gratitude to someone would be a problem. We do express gratitude, but we do it in a very large way. All of our ceremonies, all of our rituals are an expression of gratitude to the people that came before us, that who are no longer here. So, you know, your point is, I think, we don't express gratitude to the living. we express gratitude to the people who gave us this practice and are no longer with us. We express gratitude to them. So it's a good observation. The teaching does not say, oh, you know, you must express gratitude to your contemporaries. I think it's important. I think in our culture, it's extremely important. Our culture expects that we are grateful to one another. I think a sane and productive and harmonious society depends on people expressing gratitude to each other in a very personal way, in the moment, or soon after. But it's possible that in the cultures that evolved this, maybe those Asian cultures didn't see it that way. So, and I have to say, I couldn't answer that question. But it's possible that gratitude is, we in the West see expressing personal gratitude as something extremely important and very fundamental. But who knows, maybe other cultures saw it differently. But I think you make a good point, and you express a very important feeling. I think what you're saying is, for us, now, in the world we live in, it's vital that we express gratitude to each other for small things and large things. It's important. It's a part of the practice that is now being included in what we're evolving in the modern world, in the West. Gratitude has become part of our teaching, even though it's not what we might have inherited from other cultures. But because we care for each other, because we feel our relationships with each other are very important, we want to include gratitude in our relationships with each other. So I believe it is becoming and has become a part of the teaching that we will hand on to the next generation of Zen practitioners in the West. And I will leave it up to you to write the sutra about it. Yes, you bring up a very thoughtful question. Something, I'll think about that. Why does it seem to be absent? Why does it seem to be not part of our teaching? That's a good question. Thank you.
Thank you. And an opportunity to say that I'm very grateful for everyone at Kananto.
Thank you. Well, hi, Giuseppe.
I read an interview that you had probably a long, long time ago with a journalist. I think the journalist asked you, what is that you like to do? What is that you like to do? Your answer was, what's wrong with what we're doing right now? And I have, I think, read this many, many years ago, and I really wanted to be there to continue the conversation, because I think the journalist just shut up. So because it's enormous statement. I don't think you were referring it only to that moment. I think that you wanted to say that it's an attitude that you carry in every moment. But every moment has its nature, and there can be moments of all sorts, and digging illusions over illusions and so on and so forth. So my questions, if I were the journalist, would have been, what do you mean by that? How can you be okay with every moment, or not finding any fault with any moment?
Maybe I was a bit unfair to the journalists, because a journalist was doing what journalists do. That's the kind of questions that they ask. That's what they do during interviews. They want the person who's being interviewed to expose themselves and explain themselves and paint a picture of themselves. So maybe it was a little bit unfair. Maybe it made him was it him or her? I forgot.
I don't even know.
I don't know. Maybe it's uncomfortable. I think a good way to explore that question about what's important to you and what do you like to do, that kind of question, I think we have to, I think it's important to recognize that the only time we are alive is this moment. So whatever we're doing in this moment is the only thing. All of our life and all of our energy and all of our sincerity and dedication goes into this activity now, independent of whether we like it or not, or if it's our favorite thing or not. Of course, we all have our favorite things to do, or maybe our favorite things to eat or drink, or our favorite people to be with, and those sorts of things. But when it comes to our practice, we have to stand on where we are right now, because our aliveness is here right now. You know, sometimes people will say, I'm bored, or nothing interests me, or I wish I could find something exciting to do. And when somebody expresses that kind of feeling, you kind of know that they don't know how to be alive in this moment. They want something better than this moment, but there is nothing better than this moment. You know, if somebody gives us a meal, a very simple meal, and we say to ourselves, oh, I want a more exciting meal, then we can't enjoy the meal that somebody gave us as a gift. And our life becomes just one disappointing moments following each other. So to say, when somebody says to you, what's your favorite thing to do? You say, well, just this moment. This is it. Being here with you, you who are asking me this question, this is my favorite thing, because we're here right now. We are alive together right now, expressing ourselves. In an hour from now, we will be in different places with different people. That becomes our favorite thing. There's a term that's not used in Zen practice, just like gratitude is not in the teaching. There's a term that I think is vital to our practice. I call it immediacy. Living in the immediacy, the activity and the energy of this moment, this immediate moment. Sometimes people will say that Zazen period was really good. Sometimes they'll say, oh, well, it wasn't so good. It's all a matter of if we could express our immediacy of what we were doing. To be fully engaged in this moment, that needs to be our favorite thing. And I think suffering arises when we're always looking for something that's we think will be better than this immediate moment. That's real suffering. So maybe I was unfair to that interviewer or that reporter, but I don't know, maybe not.
You can also say that this is not a different not different from having what you say. You know, sometimes you call it sincerity, sometimes you call it authenticity. Sometimes I heard you using these words. You know, it's also we are immediately split if we have a judgment on what we're doing on this moment, and then who is judging anyway ourselves? You know, it's like is it possible to explain it even more with the image of the mirror that is there, and that is there in every moment and embraces everything that comes. And then everything that comes is, there's no problem with anything that comes.
There is a limit to what we should try to explain. In our practice, we have to be very judicious in choosing when is a good time to explain something and what is a good thing to explain. Usually better to leave such things unsaid and unspoken and not have a dialogue about them.
How about expressing them, so to speak, you know? Then I think we are all seeking from you that you express to us your understanding.
You know, I think I know you've read about the history of the practice and the way the ancient teachers worked with their students. And so there are times, and some of the stories that have handed down to us that touch us deeply, that we want to understand, that provide a certain a dynamic and new and creative way of looking at things. So there are stories when a student comes to his or her teacher and asks a question about something, and the teacher throws a cup of tea in the student's face. That's the extent of an explanation that the teacher gives. As if to say to the student, come in here and come see me and express yourself. Don't come to me with, it won't help you to come to me with seeking answers to questions. So, you know, there are some very, very famous stories. One involving Joshu, which everybody knows, a monk comes to his teacher Joshu and says, who is Buddha? Which is, you know, asking for an explanation. And Joshu says, the oak tree in the garden. As if all of these teaching, but by these devices and by these way of responding to their students' questions, the teachers are saying, you won't find wisdom by seeking explanation to those kinds of questions. You have to see in another way. Or in other words, go back and continue your practice. Don't worry about explanations. They may feel satisfying, but they won't really help you if you're serious about this practice.
A great version of a slap through Zoom. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about the slaps. It is so encouraging. To me, it is so encouraging and so satisfying to see all of you here tonight with the New Year's Eve just a few hours away. This, for us to spend our last, to be with each other on the eve of New Year's Eve, when this year is ending, when this very difficult year is ending, to come together in friendship, and solidarity, and to spend this time with each other as we approach a year that we don't know what will bring. This is this meeting tonight is the perfect way to start a new year. Hmm. All of us together saying, look at us, we're together. Difficult times in the past, who knows what's ahead, but we are together. And we're going to continue our practice together. This is a wonderful meeting tonight.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. And thank you, Teresa, for suggesting it. But I think we are at time, running out of time.
Yes. Thank you, Les. I agree. This is a wonderful evening spent together, and I hope we can have more of these.
We can.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.